Okay, we are in Habakkuk, that minor prophet. I kind of expected that we'd be through with the book within a matter of maybe 3 or 4 weeks, and here we are in week number 4, I believe, and we are still in chapter number 1. And we'll be picking up at verse 14 in just a few minutes. Before that, I want to read you something. This comes very early on in the Bible, in the book of Deuteronomy. We've talked about this, how morality was out the window in Jerusalem and Judah in the days that Habakkuk was prophesying, and how terrible, violent things were happening around every corner. And how the prophet had made a plea to God about this, crying out to God, do something, do something, do something. I see violence. And you don't seem to be doing anything. But then God spoke, and he said, I'm going to do something in your time that you're not even going to believe, even though I'm going to tell you. I'm going to raise up the dreaded Chaldeans or Babylonians and bring judgment by their hand. Now we look upon that. We can put our feet probably very well in the shoes of Habakkuk, because he was like dumbfounded. He was blown away when God said that to him. He questioned God how he could possibly use those wicked, terrible people to bring judgment on the people who are called by his name. I just want to remind us of something, of a history of Israel and Judah of constant, unrelenting rebellion that has gone on for century after century after century. Around 800 years have transpired between the time that these words were written by Moses, given by God, and the time in history that we happen to be at right now with this prophet. 800 years. Of long-suffering. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 27 and 28. Remember when God had given instructions to Moses that when they came into the promised land that they were going to have a covenant renewal ceremony, and it was going to be, half of Israel was going to be on one mountain, Mount Ebal, and the other half of the country of Israel was going to be on the other mountain, Mount Gerizim, and they were going to shout back and forth to each other. One was going to shout blessings, the other one cursings. Blessings if you're obedient. Blessings if you do what the Lord has brought you to do or told you to do. Cursings, on the other hand, if you don't. But just these are the words from Deuteronomy. It shall be, if you diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. All these blessings will come upon you if you obey the Lord your God. If you do not obey the Lord your God, the Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, who have no respect for the old, nor show any favor to the young. It shall besiege you in all your towns until your high and fortified walls, in which you trust, come down throughout your land. Then you will eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and daughters. The Lord will bring extraordinary plagues upon you. The Lord will scatter you among the nations. You shall not rest. So no one in Judah in this day could say, well, we just didn't know. I mean, it's put down in those words, and this is not the only place you find this kind of thing in Scripture, but very, very clearly, a call to covenant faithfulness. Blessings if you're covenantly faithful, cursings if you're not. So it's not like God just decided overnight, well, you know, I put up with these people from Judah, you know, these folks for just a few weeks, and they're not doing what I wanted to do, so I'm going to bring the Babylonians on them. This has been going on, kind of a love-hate relationship. And I don't want to say God always loved Israel, but you need to understand that Israel didn't always love God. Going on for generation after generation after generation, and they were constantly called to covenantal faithfulness. The reason God sent for the prophets was for that very reason, to renew, to call them back to the covenant that God had made with them. And rather than repent, they just continued to do things just like they've been doing them all along. But the thing about it is if you look at it, you'll see that the wickedness and evilness, the degree of it, gets worse and worse and worse and worse. So much so, by the time that Jeremiah and Habakkuk appear on the scene, that the Bible describes Judah as not being like Sodom and Gomorrah, but Judah being worse than Sodom and Gomorrah. And we talked about this last week, and we said that there's a sense in which the sins, did the Babylonians have great sins? Yes, they did. They were wicked, evil, terrible people. But there's a sense in which the sins of Judah were worse because God had given them his revelation. He had given the law to them. He had revealed himself to them in very great ways and manners through the history of their nation in ways that the Babylonians were totally oblivious to. So, I mean, who in this picture is more accountable? The Babylonians, as Habakkuk seems to think, or the people of Judah, as God seems to think. Have you ever questioned God's intentions? Have your question is motives. This is some of what Habakkuk is doing. As we said last week, one of the big problems is this, is we all have the tendency to see our sin not very well and the sins of others so very clearly. In other words, and Habakkuk is doing that in a sense of the whole congregation of Israel. I mean, he would have been the first to say, he's already said that. He's already told God that he sees this violence, he sees dishonesty, he sees an injustice over and over again. He knows there are issues in Judah. But even in light of that, he seems to have in his mind that the sins of Judah are lesser than the sins of the Babylonians. Because his demeanor basically is, how, Lord, why would you ever use those most horrible, terrible, awful people on the face of the planet as your instrument of justice upon your people? May it never be done. We think about Habakkuk, we need to be thinking about some verbs like bewildered, dumbfounded, overwhelmed, perplexed, confounded, confused, without words to express fully what he's feeling. Flabbergasted. So Habakkuk questions God. How could you do such a thing? There really is another question here, and it's the question that should be being asked. And you hear the question mentioned by people like Daniel in his prayer in Daniel chapter 9. The question that should be on the minds of everyone is this, is why have you waited so long to do this? Not why are you doing it, but why have you waited so very long to do what you're about to do? You see, very often, even believers, we ask the wrong questions because we're most concerned about particular answers. And I want to challenge us this idea this morning, and I've known I've done that a few times through here, is we need to understand something, that the New Testament equivalent of Old Testament Israel / Judah is the church. It's not the world. I mean, in other words, whatever message we glean from this today has a lot more meaning directly upon and bearing upon the church than it does the world around us. Why have you made men like the fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? Kind of an odd thing to say. I don't feel too much like a fish, do you? Some people may call you a creeping thing on occasion. I mean, do we have fins? Do we have scales? Do we have gills? Do we breathe water instead of air? Are we slippery and slimy? Well, maybe some of that. So one of the things we need to be asking ourselves is, how in the world are people like fish? Because we don't see any likeness at all. Well, we can say some things. One of those is this, is that is God made both, right? God's the creator. He created fish. He also created people. However, he had very different purposes for the two. Both of them, in some sense, are there to bring honor and glory to him, even a fish. Every creature that lives on the planet. Sometimes I wonder this, that when the birds are singing, what are they saying? Could it be that they're singing praises to God and we just don't even know it? Certainly a possibility. The point I want to make this morning is this, is that man plays a very key, central figure part in this whole picture. That even though he is a creature made by God, he's made by God for a very special purpose. And his special purpose is this, is that we would bear his image. That's made so clear back in the very first chapter of Genesis. Secularists today, they look upon you and I as just another piece of meat. We may have a brain in there so we can think better than other organisms, things like that. But they wouldn't see anything very special about people. We're just the product of evolution. This takes place over the years. And so the only thing, the difference between us and a fish is we've advanced a little bit more evolutionary-wise than the fish has. They see no special place for man in God's big picture. Fish sometimes travel in schools. Have you noticed that? I love all the video stuff that you get on the internet today. Lots of pictures and beautiful pictures. And every now and then you'll see a video of a school of fish. And it's really, and if you've ever been snorkeling or diving, you've seen some of this actually face-to-face in real life yourself. And that is this. They'll be moving along this mass of fish, and then all of a sudden, they change direction totally. And it's almost in unison. It's almost like it's a planned thing. It doesn't seem to me, however, that fish schools actually have a leader. In other words, there's not a fish there that everybody else is following after all the time. Maybe there is on occasion. But what do you think makes them change direction like that very often? Well, maybe they're going after food, or maybe somebody's coming after them for food, right? But we would classify fish as kind of dumb animals. You know, they don't have what we call lots of knowledge and understanding about things. In other words, the circumstances kind of direct what they're doing. And that's all. If there's a predator that way, we're going to go that way instead. Fish will do everything they can to reduce the risk of being eaten. And that sort of thing. They don't really have what we call a ruler. In other words, you think about bees, for instance. You know, bees have a queen, and there really is a queen bee in the hive. And the whole hive is dependent upon her. Fish, on the other hand, seem to be in a little bit of a different category. They don't seem to have a distinct leader. I think one of the points that the prophet's trying to make here is this. Is that you can understand fish behaving the way that they do and doing the things that they do. because they're driven because of their circumstances at the moment. Do they have a sense of God? Who knows? It's very doubtful they know much about God. The sad thing about people, one of the saddest things about people, is they very clearly have a ruler. And lots of them never even acknowledge that at all, ever. Therefore, they could be likened to fish, driven by circumstances, going hither or there for no real reason for doing it. Man is also likened to fish here by Habakkuk for a reason that goes beyond that, and that is the verse that follows, where we read these words, "The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away in their net, and gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore they rejoice and be glad." So the picture is being painted here is just as a fisherman catches fish with hooks and catches fish with nets, the Babylonians are going to come and they're going to do the same thing to the people of Judah. Literally. This is one of the things that they were noted for. They were noted to be extremely cruel to the people they captured. And one of the things they did very commonly is they actually put fish hooks in them to keep them bound to other people. So if one runs, you know what's going to happen. Now, doesn't that sound awful? You ever had a fish hook on you? Nancy has. You know they're hard to get out, right? My grandfather, we were fishing one time down on the intercoastal way over there, St. Augustine, and he got a little fish hook. We were just fishing for mullet. And he got one of them stuck in his finger. And he sat there for an hour trying to get it out. He even took his pocket knife out and cut his finger open a little bit, trying to get it. He went having to go to the emergency room. You know how they got it out? This is where I learned the lesson. You have to push it the rest of the way through because of that barb on it. See, hooks, once they're set, they're intended to stay in there for as long as you wanted to be in there. And they're very good at doing that. Matthew one time hooked Nancy in the leg. What'd I do, Nancy? Cut it off, pushed it through. Stephen came home one day after fishing with his cousins, and he had a lure hanging on his cheek. How do we get that one off? We cut it off and pushed it through. No one would want to have a fish hook put in them that has any sense at all. But we know this, that once a fish is hooked, now we do know that fish can sometimes get off the hook at the, you know, at the sadness of the person who's trying to catch them. But just think of the effect that a fish hook has on a fish. It's tied to a line, right? And that line is all about control. Before that time, that fish could swim anywhere it wanted to, any direction it wanted to go in, as long as it was willing to risk maybe being eaten somewhere or something like that. But as far as its will to move from one place to the other, had it always been able to do that. Now, all of a sudden, it has to deal with total lack of control of being actually pulled in a direction it doesn't want to go in. A lot of my fondest memories of my boys is fishing with them. Stephen, first time he took him out, he wanted to catch a redfish, something awful, and he was maybe 5 or 6 years old or something like that. And, of course, I had a I had a reel and rod that I was using. Matthew was with us, I think. I think Lori was with us that time, too. But we're just fishing, and I didn't have a lot of good fishing equipment in those days, but I obviously was using the best stuff I had. And as you went down the line, the younger they got, the worse it was. And Stephen had my real leftover thing from years past. And here we are, and he hooks into a redfish, a big one. And he turns to me, and he's got the fishing pole in one hand, and the reel is in his other hand. It came off. And finally, I said, "Stephen, give it to me, and I'll get the fish in." And I did. I managed to get it in. But he looked at me and said, "But I'm the one that caught it. Don't you make sure you told everybody that." But fishing is something that we take pleasure in sometimes. Maybe pleasurable for us, but is it ever a pleasure for the fish? We also know that fish are sometimes caught by nets, right? And we know what a net does. Traps them in. Takes away their freedom, again, to go wherever they want to go. History tells us, guys, that fishing nets and fishing hooks were commonly used by the Babylonians to control their captives, to force them to go where they did not want to go. We just need to understand who we're dealing with here. Do you know of anybody that does anything like that today? Well, we do know there's some people that are really bad to the people they capture. But just remember, this is the picture of this sweeping army of the Babylonians. They're just coming. They're coming from afar, and everywhere they go, they decimate everything in their path. They don't live anything they leave living, they take captive of. They don't just pass over people and say, "Well, we're just going to let you go." They were determined to destroy everything in their path, to bring in total subjection every person that they captured. Their cruelty seems to have had no limits. It kind of reminds you of some of the stuff that's going on as far as terrorists today, right? They seem to have no respect for human life at all. And what I would say to you this, and you can mark my words on that, they don't have any respect for human life because they have no respect for the true living God. Even though they would be the first to tell you they do, they have absolutely no respect for God. Or those made in his image. Therefore, they offer sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing nets, because through these things their catch is large and their food plentiful. These guys are idolaters. Matter of fact, they not only have one God, they have a whole list of gods. Let me give you a few names. Marduk was the one that most people knew of. But then there's Nintu, and there's Anshar, and Anu, and Apsu, and Damkina, and Ea, and Enlil, and Ishtar, and Mummu. Only some of them. Did they really and literally make sacrifices to their nets and burn incense to them? We would say probably not, but I'd say quite likely, yes. That everything that they saw that gave them power in success over everyone else. They considered it to be a god. We might ask, well, what in the world would they sacrifice to their net that they use for capturing people from Judah and other places? I mean, if it's a fisherman, and a fisherman came in and they gave a sacrifice to God to just give him praise because of the bountiful fish he caught. So what would be possibly going on here? Well, we're talking about the very good chance they were human sacrifices. And some of these people that are captured in these nets, they were taken. And they were used for sacrifice. Isn't that kind of scary that in every place they look and they see success, every place they look and they see power manifested or something, they invent some god? The sad thing about it is this, is Habakkuk has already said this. Did they see themselves as god because of their power? We know this, that there is a human propensity to idol worship, right? We know that's true. History attests to it over and over again. Do we live in a culture today where none of that kind of stuff takes place? Idol worship? It has to say that we do. I mean, our culture seems to be just bent on more and more and more. Wealth, wealth, wealth. Get this, I want that. I'll make that for you for so much money. I got the money. Here it is. I don't have the money. I'll pay you back in 50 years and a lot of interest too. People today, it's a sad day because this is a day in the good old US of A that people are still desperately trying to find fulfillment and happiness and all the good things in life in buying material possessions. Any pleasure that any of those things bring to anybody is short-lived, if there's any real pleasure about it at all. Right? Go home and look around your house and ask yourself this question: how much of this stuff do I really need? I mean, we have our own idols. But you know who ultimately is the idol of every person? Self. Self. We're most concerned about ourselves. Most concerned when something happens, how that's going to affect me. Most concerned that we're taken care of every day. Most concerned that we don't have any aches and pains. Most concerned, most concerned, most concerned. As much as we might like it to be otherwise, God very typically falls way down the scale. So we should be able to understand idol worshipers. We should also be able to understand how silly and ridiculous idol worship is. It's never accomplished one good thing for anybody, ever. Do we sacrifice to our nets? Do we burn incense to our fishing nets? Maybe there's a sense in which we even do that. Now, how many of you spend more time primping your car than you do hardly anything else? There were a lot of things going on in the history for the Babylonians at that point that actually encouraged them to believe that they were gods, that they were more important because they were more powerful. we need to be very careful not to follow suit. Very often in the church today, success is measured by numbers. How many people? It's all about quantity, very little about quality sometimes. I saw something the other day that wanted me to make me want to puke. And this is a person that's pretty well known in our culture, the Christian culture today. And this is what he was saying. He's saying that you're doing a disservice to your children. You're being selfish if you don't take your children to a big church. And let me tell you, if I told you who it was, it would probably surprise you. And that's exactly what he was preaching. I listened to it and it went on for 5 or 10 minutes. That everybody must be in a big church, and if you're not, then you're something less. You're selfish. You're self-centered. You don't really want what's best for your kids, because what's best for them is bigger and better. Well, we understand this, that fishing has a lot of appearance in the Bible, right? Do we remember the first thing that Jesus said to Peter and to Andrew and James and John? I will what? I will make you fishers of men. So we have to realize that there is an application of this whole fisherman concept to church people, but in a totally different manner. We understand that one of the picture that the Bible paints in relationship to people is that people are of either one camp or one school or another. They're either part of the fellowship of God or they're part of the fellowship of Satan. There is no in between. I think a lot of people believe that you can be both at the same time, that you can have one foot in hell and one foot in heaven at the same time, and that just doesn't work. You need to understand that. There's a sense in which we are really stupid, dumb fish. That's because if it were not for God's grace, there would be no one in God's school. Period. If he just left us where we were, swimming around with all the other fish who didn't know their right from their left. You're here this morning because Jesus went fishing for you. And he caught you. He didn't almost catch you. He didn't lose you that day only to catch you some other day. When Jesus catches fish, he catches fish. And he will never, ever. He's not a catch and release guy. When you're his forever. That's one of the greatest promises of the gospel. And let me ask you something. What else in this world, what kind of promise comes even close to something like that? There is nothing. He also calls us fishers of men. You and me. because his school gets ever bigger. And he wants us to be a part of that. As we said last week, we have a tendency right now to look upon everything going on as being negative, negative, negative. There's certainly lots of reason to be negative, negative, negative about things. But at the same time, if you look through history, what you'll find is very often when places, peoples, nations get to where we are, that is a point when God brings about very great revival. And I hope you're praying for a revival. And I hope you're praying for not just a revival, but a reformation. In other words, where a large percentage of people will come back to the true understandings of the doctrines of grace and that sort of thing. Easter's coming. Invitations are on the table out there. I hope they're gone by the end of the service. And Karen will put some more out there. I mean, don't you want this? Don't you relish this for God, really? That this room on Sundays would be full of people. Now, we want it because we want more people. It makes us feel better if there's more people here. And it's disturbing to look out and see empty chairs and, you know, things like that. But that's entirely the wrong reason. Our desire and passion and zeal for Springs Presbyterian Church needs to be founded in our passion and our zeal for the Lord Jesus Christ. And we want this building filled for one reason, and that is he deserves it. So how many people are out there today that are not praising God, that will be praising God in the next few weeks? Or months. Be a part of it. Because if we're not part of it, guys, we're part of the problem.